fraud isn't on anyone's holiday wish list, but it's a real problem in this busy season of transactions. As more brick-and-mortar businesses now require chip credit cards to buy things, many fraudsters are shifting their attention to the online space. We're starting with fraud-related questions on this edition of On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Hi there, Kevin.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a personal finance question, regardless of what it is, join in at 800-642-1234. Send your money question by email at onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post it on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Last week, we had a special membership drive edition of On Your Money, and Kevin offered an On Your Money mini money booklet to everyone who pledged to Wisconsin Public Radio during the hour. What were the results, Kevin?
Kate, the On Your Money mini money booklet was called 15 Ways to Fight Fraud, and there were ideas in there how to protect your identity, some suggestions about freezing and monitoring your credit reports, how to come up with the best passwords, and On Your Money listeners came through in an overwhelming response. On the Tuesday morning live pledge show, 413 listeners pledged a total of $23,589. Then on Saturdays at noon, our beloved weekend listeners came in with 249 pledges for $13,607. The grand total for just last week was 662 pledges for $37,196. And it was a stellar year. We are eternally grateful to On Your Money listeners for who pledged and how much they pledged in total. For 2017, On Your Money listeners pledged 2,857 people pledged a total of $178,511. And thank you very, very much for all of you who supported the show.
And we're going to use this hour to express our gratitude to the generous listeners. Yes?
As we promised, Kate, on the last week's show, if we met our goals and when we met our goals, which we blew through thanks to you, we were going to spend this entire hour devoting our time to answering your financial questions that you can send in via email at onyourmoney@wpr.org or send it to me directly, kevin@onyourmoney.com. Call in during the show if you wish, and we'll try to get to all of the questions we can.
Let's start with a question from a listener who asks, does freezing credit for myself also freeze my spouse's credit?
Yeah, freezing credit, a lot of people have a misunderstanding of what happens here. Freezing credit means freezing your credit report. When you go to apply for a credit card or a loan, the lender pulls your credit report from usually one of the three main credit bureaus and then looks at it and decides whether or not to give you a loan or the credit. Freezing it means that the crooks can't use your information to contact a lender, request, let's say, a credit card, but then have the bills redirected to a different address, via a PO box. And so they would get the credit, charge up the credit card, and then move, or the address would be a phantom address. Now, usually if that happens to you, you have no liability, but it can be a huge hassle. And even after you resolve the issue with the creditor, it can haunt you again in the future because that debt can be resold to bill collectors, and you have to explain it away for the rest of your life.
So how does a person freeze their credit report?
They contact each bureau, and usually you can do it online, and there's often a cost to it, but it can be free depending on your situation and depending on the state in question. It might cost about $10. And once you freeze it, it means that only people who have a relationship with you already, meaning only your current credit card company or mortgage company or auto loan company, can check that information for it. If you do freeze your credit report and then you go in down the road and you need to borrow money, what happens is usually the lender will say, hey, we tried to access your credit report. It's frozen and we're using, say, Equifax. And you'd say, okay, I'll contact Equifax. I'll open up my report for 48 hours, give you a chance to look at the information, and then I'll lock it back up again afterwards. And you can get more information on how to do this at tinyurl.com/credfreeze, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website onyourmoney.com later on today.
And circling back to the question, if you freeze your own credit report, then is your spouse's automatically frozen as well?
Yeah, that's right. I guess there was a question there, wasn't there? Each person
just keeping you honest, Kevin.
Thank you. Each person is treated individually. Each spouse or partner in a relationship has to freeze his or her own credit report. But something to keep in mind, you can freeze other people's credit report with their permission, especially if they're children. They might be older relatives who may not be able to navigate the process because it is a little tricky to do it, especially if you're trying to do it online. But ironically, people who are younger, older, maybe a little less tech savvy are the people who are actually more vulnerable to having their identity stolen and credits open up in credit cards open up in their name. So those are the people you really want to look out for.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And your questions, your money questions, they have the floor this hour, 800-642-1234. Do you have a pressing money question that has been on your mind? Join in at 800-642-1234 to ask it directly to Kevin. You can also send it by email on yourmoney@wpr.org. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We had Penny, who joined us from Elkhart, and was wondering about PayPal. Wondering whether, from Elkhart Lake, who wants to know if PayPal is a more secure way to pay for things online.
Well, it's more secure in the sense that you're not exposing your credit card account or your debit card account number online. You're not typing that in. PayPal acts kind of as an intermediary to handle transactions for people who have accounts. It's a little easier to trace because it's hard to open up a PayPal account if you don't have verifiable information. But that said, because it's online, if PayPal needs to get at your information, in theory, anyone can get at that information as well. And PayPal has had issues like almost every other online service that offers these kinds of transactions and credit card companies, et cetera, has had a hack where people got in, and I think 1.6 million users' information was exposed. And usually what happens is once the company discovers the hack, acknowledges it, they send a notice out to customers who may be affected, and then they have them probably change their login information, password information, so that the hackers don't have that information anymore at their hands. So yeah, I've used PayPal, and I've been very happy with it when I've used it in the past. It's nice in some cases because it allows you to actually draw money directly from your checking account. So if you don't want to expose your credit card information, or you just want to pay cash for something online, it's a relatively inexpensive and very secure way, but it's not perfect. Nothing is.
Let's go to Rachel, who joins us from Wausau with a question. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm dealing with a mountain of student debt. I went back to school, and I got a second degree. As a result, I'm now dealing with six figures of student debt, lots of loans from multiple different vendors. And I really had difficulty finding somebody who can advise me on how best to manage, these multiple loans with different terms. And I'm looking at over six figures in student loans, and it's just overwhelming, and I just don't know where to start with it.
Right. Are you looking, Rachel, in the sense of saying, I can't make these payments? You're just saying, I don't know where my next dollar should go. Which one should I pay off?
So I am working full-time, and right now it's in an income-based loan repayment plan, but that's based on my last year's income. So right now my payments are zero, but next year it's going to be based on this current income, and the payments will be huge. It's more than I could afford every month. And I know there's different forgiveness programs. I guess part of my quandary is that I literally have dozens of different types of federal loans, and they all have different terms. And I guess I just don't know how to manage these.
Yeah, have you contacted anybody to ask them, anybody who services the loans yet, to ask them what your options are?
I have, and, I've tried. So I have my education was through a couple of different universities. I've tried those financial aid offices. They just aren't able to advise me. I've actually sought out professional advice from some financial advisors, and they just aren't knowledgeable enough. And they'll tell me that they just don't know the best options to advise me. They can advise me on saving for college, but now when it comes to repayment and the different terms, I just haven't gotten anywhere.
Okay. Well, the first thing I would say is, since these are federal loans, if you're concerned about your income not being high enough to pay the loans off, you can go into are you in the income-based repayment plan already or not?
I am.
Okay. That's a good start. And then I would look at, it's very difficult to get out of paying student loans. Even people who die sometimes are still on the hook. Their estates or their families can still be on the hook for the student loan debt. And part of the reason is because it's an unsecuritized loan, and therefore it would be relatively easy for people to say, hey, I'm going to get this education and I'm going to hopefully benefit from the education in the form of higher earnings, but I'm going to declare bankruptcy, and then after 7 years or whatever the time frame is, those are going to be off my record and start over again. And that would be a really great situation to have. The problem is that someone came up with that money to lend to us to use to go for education. They would be out the money unless the government's just going to say, oh, well, we'll print up a bunch more and here you go. It's difficult to get out from under them. The income-based repayment plan is really the only way that you can modify the payments so that you can adjust them downward while still staying current. And then if you stay current under today's laws anyways, if you still stay current for a period of time, whatever the remaining balance is, it can be forgiven. But we don't know if that will be the case in the future. There's a website called Student Loan Hero. That's a commercial website that I would start with, Rachel. See what they have to offer. Be very careful about consolidating.
Did you say Student Loan Hero?
Yeah, studentloanhero.com. And be very careful, though, about don't consolidate these federal loans into a private lender, because you lose a lot of these income-based repayment options and forgiveness options that you have on federal loans that usually aren't available with private loans. And other than that, I would go directly to the government website it's the same one that you use to fill out the FAFSA, and contact one of their service people and say, here's my situation. They'll be able to pull it up and they'll look at it, Rachel, and say, well, here's what you can do. Sadly, you are going to have to pay off the loans in some form or the other. If you've got $100,000, it's probably going to take at least $1,000 a month over 10 years' time to pay that off. As a rule of thumb, usually whatever your student loan balance is, if you make 1% of the original balance paid every single month, you usually pay it off at about 10 years. But you're right, it is a lot of money.
Well, Rachel, good luck. Thanks for the call. And you can call in with your personal finance question, regardless of what it is. Join in at 800-642-1234. Send your money-related question via email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can post it on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Olivia emailed to ask, and she says, greetings. I'm wondering about the Wisconsin EdVest program for college education for dependent children. What are the benefits of the program? What are the downfalls?
Well, the benefits, Olivia, are that you get to put money into this account for your child or some other person who may or may not be using it for college at some point down the road. And if you're a Wisconsin resident, you get a small tax break on the deposit. You get a state tax break on every $3,100, no more than that, that you put into the account. So if you put in $3,100 for a child, let's say, into an EdVest program, your taxable income at the state level will be reduced for that year by $3,100. State tax rate in Wisconsin's on average of about maybe 5%. So that might save you, $100 to $150 on your taxes, which is not nothing, especially on $3,100. Then the money is invested through your choice of different options, kind of like a 401k or a 403b that you might have at work. And then any earnings are sheltered from taxation. And if they're pulled out and used for qualified higher education, and that definition is pretty generous, if they're used for qualified higher education expenses, then any earnings are tax-free. So those are the advantages. And also, parents or grandparents or anyone else who opens these up for a child keeps control over the money. So if they decide they don't want to help the kid out or the kid doesn't go to college, it's still the parent or the original account owner's money. So those are the advantages. The disadvantages are if you don't use the EdVest account or any other college savings, 529 college savings program for qualified higher education expenses, and you just take it out, you will owe taxes on the earnings plus a 10% penalty. So if you put in, let's say, $10,000 into the account and it grows to $1,100 and you pull it out and you take a vacation with it, that's fine, but you're going to pay taxes on the $1,000 of earnings plus a 10% penalty on that. So you probably lose about 30 to 40% of the earnings portion only in the form of taxes. But for people looking to actually save money for college, it's a nice way to do it. Just be very cautious that keep in mind that usually we have a very short window to invest for children and even an even shorter window with which we draw the money out for college. So you usually can't afford to be as aggressive with that money as you might be if you were saving for retirement.
Olivia, thanks for that question. We challenged you and you delivered on the recently concluded year-end membership drive. Hundreds of On Your Money fans brought support for WPR and got the mini money booklet Fighting Fraud in return. The floor is yours on this edition of On Your Money. Bring your question at 800-642-1234. Kevin McKinley is here. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And we'll be back with more of your money questions and concerns after a brief break. We're back on this edition of On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring the varied questions you have about money in all stages of life. One of the toughest decisions in life is chasing down a dream and pursuing exactly what you love to do. What are your financial goals in 2018? What money question is on your mind? Ask away at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is here. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Let's go to Vivian, who joins us from Marinette. Hi, Vivian.
Good morning. My daughter's FAFSA has been submitted and approved, and I was wondering when her credit should be frozen. What is the freeze-thaw cycle when we're filling out the FAFSA form for our daughter?
Yeah, especially in the winter, your mind is focused on freezing and thawing cycles, right? Yeah, it can be just about as treacherous when you're trying to navigate not only the FAFSA, but also the credit freezing process. And usually, Vivian, is she submitting this for, I'm guessing, is it the fall of 2018 semester?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I would guess it's probably going to be March or April in which they actually are going to look at her credit information. But did you contact the financial aid office at the school and ask that, and they weren't able to help you?
We're going to do that.
Okay, that's what I would suggest. And because they don't do it all at once, all in one day, they'll probably, what I'm guessing has happened is hopefully they have a procedure in place to deal with this. If they don't, what'll happen is they'll review it, and then they'll say, I'm sorry, we tried to review it, but we couldn't get at the information because you've wisely frozen your credit. Could you open it back up again and then freeze it? And you might want to maybe leave it open for a few weeks during that time period just to make sure they get at the information and they get what they need out of it. But to then, of course, monitor any of your personal information, your credit card accounts, et cetera. And then you also may want to go into annualcreditreport.com, and that allows you to look at each one of your credit reports once free per bureau per year, annualcreditreport.com. Vivian, we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. And then just make sure that you find out which bureau they're actually using, if indeed they do need to look at our credit report.
Vivian,
thank you.
Yeah, Vivian, thanks so much for the call. Roxanne from Madison emailed us to ask, my student loan interest just went up almost a full percent. Kevin, how do I know when it's time to refinance?
Yeah, you really don't. And when interest rates are historically low right now and unlikely to go much lower, it's probably a good time to lock it in. But the problem with refinancing, of course, is that, as I mentioned earlier, You have to be very careful, especially when you're discussing federal loans versus private loans, because federal loans, if you roll those into a package, refinance, and consolidate them with a private lender, you lose some of the advantages that federal loans have. So try to do it. Don't transfer a federal loan into a private lender, because that can make it tougher to repay it if you run into trouble.
Let's take another call now with Mike joining us from Lodi. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning. Curious what your opinion is on cryptocurrencies, specifically Litecoin. We invested roughly $1,000 to $1,200, five coins yesterday, $225 apiece, and now they're pushing $400. I'm regretting, should I have spent a lot more on that? Or being so volatile, is it something to stay away from?
Yeah, Mike, do us all a favor here. Explain what cryptocurrencies are.
Cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin is the one that's been huge in the media lately. It's, I guess, online, non-government regulated currencies that are, I think they just started maybe trading in the actual exchange now with Bitcoin. I'm just learning a lot about it, but it seems, I doubled my money almost.
So far, so good, right?
Yeah. So,
Who cares? Who cares what it is? If you double your money on it, it doesn't make any difference. Yeah, we're going to talk more about this after the first of the year. My cryptocurrencies, as you mentioned, Bitcoin is the most ubiquitous, but there are dozens of cryptocurrencies out there, and they're basically computer locked in codes which allow people allegedly to mine the currency so that they can use it to buy other things or as a store of value. Now, that's good and bad news. The good news is it's been a wild market. Bitcoin has gone from, I think, $1,000 maybe a year ago up to in the $18,000 or $19,000 in value. That's good news and that's bad news. The other bad news about it is that it's a currency, which means you have to know or hope or think that when you actually need to convert it into something else that actually has value to you, meaning food or shelter, gasoline, clothes, donations to Wisconsin Public Radio, whatever you're going to do, you need to hope that the person on the other side of that is going to accept it at that value and at least the same dollar amount that you paid for it. And that's no different than if people all of a sudden decided that, let's say, sticks were currency now. You could go out, and as long as someone would give you a gallon of milk for a stick, it now has value to it. But if people all of a sudden decide, well, wait, that's just a stick. That doesn't have any worth to me. I can't convert it into anything else. I can't take the stick and then pay my rent with it. Then that's when all of a sudden the currency becomes worthless. And right now, cryptocurrencies are a huge bubble. And anything that can go up that much in a short period of time can go down in at least as short of a time. And so if you are going to invest in it, I don't consider it investing. I consider it speculating and gambling. And it's okay to speculate and gamble as long as it's money that you can afford to lose. Because there, for every story of, hey, I bought this cryptocurrency a week ago, it's now worth three times my money, there is another story of, well, it dropped 50% in an hour, or hey, it's just gone. That was the cryptocurrency store was hacked, and by store I don't mean a place you buy things. I mean the storage facility of it was hacked, and all of the cryptocurrencies were stolen, and now I don't have anything left in there. So if you're going to use it, don't put any money in there that you can't afford to see go to zero.
Well, Mike, thanks for the question. Here's a question from Steve who says, hi, Kevin and Kate. My wife and I love the show. We are both 30 and have no children. After living well below our means for several years, we have plenty of savings and no debt and are lucky enough to have the opportunity to spend some time away from work. We plan to leave our jobs in March 2018, and we're going to go on an extended backpacking trip, a couple thousand miles on the Pacific Crest Trail. We've been researching financial and tax strategies to prepare for the trip and wonder if you have any suggestions. So far, what we are planning is, number one, we're going to put 100% of our January-February income into our 401ks to minimize taxable income and make sure that we qualify for ACA health insurance subsidies in 2018. Number two, we learned from our four-year show about the possibility of rolling part of our traditional 401k balances into Roth IRAs and having the rollover taxed based on our 2018 bracket. We'll probably start working again in the fall of 2018. Is there anything else we should consider or be careful about?
Oh, I'm sorry, Kate. Could you repeat that? I wasn't paying attention.
Oh, my goodness.
This sounds like a really great deal. And I love their plan, but I love what they're doing as well. People who maybe saw the movie Wild, based on a true story starring Reese Witherspoon, this was her hike along the Pacific Coast Trail. But I also like the financial part of it. And I love the notion of saving for goals that you can do now. And when they're 30, it's going to be a lot easier to hike than if they say, this is a lifetime dream of ours, so we're just going to wait until we can actually retire and take the time to do this. That's a good idea as well, but it will be a lot easier and a lot more enjoyable to do when your knees are 30 years old rather than when your knees and your eyes and your ears and your brain are 60 or 65 years old. And I love them saving for the goals, saying we're going to take a break, and then we're going to get back to our so-called daily lives, but the habits that they developed by accelerating all of their savings and really dropping their spending will help them with their future goals, other adventures that they might be planning, or their retirement.
So what about their specific financial moves before this big trip? What do you think?
I think it's perfect timing for their situation to defer taxes while their income is high in 2017 and then 2018. And using the 401k, they may even be able to qualify for an IRA as well, and they'd have to make the contribution by April 15th of the following year. And then paying taxes while their income is non-existent or low by converting money from a Roth, from an IRA to a Roth IRA, or contributing to a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k. And the neat thing about this is if they do decide to convert money from an IRA to a Roth IRA, they would want to do it in 2018. But if they then do their taxes in April of 2019, under today's laws anyway, they can go back in if it didn't quite work out to their best advantage. They can basically undo the conversion and say, we're going to erase that. It's called a recharacterization, and it's actually a fairly common technique.
Any other financial issues they should consider?
Yeah, if you're thinking about doing this yourself, according to the PCTA.org website, that's the Pacific Crest Trail Association website, it costs between $4,000 and $8,000 to make the entire trek, and that can be, you know, food along the way. It can be meeting people up and getting different boots or whatever that you might wear out. They definitely want to open up as many credit cards as they possibly can and then leave the balances uncharged and then take the cards with them so that if something comes up down the road that they have a big expense for, they can hopefully put it on the credit cards to get it done and then worry about paying the bills off later. They should notify their financial institutions that they may be using their credit and their debit cards in a different area than where they would do it. I tried to use mine on a trip about a week ago, and it wasn't available because they said, you didn't let us know you were going out of town. Well, I went to Indianapolis for the stupid Big Ten championship to watch the Badgers lose. Indianapolis is not that far away from Wisconsin. It's not like it's a dramatic trip, but they said, no, we're not going to let you use it because it's out of network. I appreciate the security, but it's definitely an inconvenience, and I would want this couple to not have to suffer that. They should also check their health insurance to make sure it's in force and that the providers along the trek are in the network so that it can be used. And also they might want to see if they can get an evacuation rider on an insurance policy. So if they trip and fall, sprain their ankle or whatever, it can be $10,000 to $20,000 to get taken out of any remote area via a helicopter, let's say. And sounds like a lot of fun, but it can be difficult and very expensive. And if they don't have the money to pay for it, even more so. They want to know that their medical records are accessible so that if they do run into a health issue, whoever the providers are can get at them. And then they should freeze their credit report and get online access to their financial accounts so they can manipulate any information that they need. And finally, this is a little disappointing, but everybody else needs to have this in place anyway, but especially when you're going on an adventure like this. They should set up wills, healthcare powers of attorney, durable powers of attorney, and make sure their beneficiaries to all their investment accounts are named. it's not likely to come into play, but if it does, their relatives, their family members, their loved ones, their friends, whomever, will be very happy they took all these steps to make a tragedy a little less tragic for everybody else involved.
So quite a few more things on their to-do list before they set out on this exciting adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the phones now. Judy joins us from Juneau. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Thank you for the show. I'm 64, about to turn 65 next year. This question is about the Medicare premium, the Part B. I was thinking of taking Social Security at age 70, or definitely beyond 65. But then I found out that the premium for Part B is different. And I was warned by one financial advisor that in the future, that premium could, we didn't say skyrocket, but it could really increase a lot more than the premium if you would take it with your Social Security at age 65.
Yeah, you have to pay. You have to pay it in advance. This is a very arcane system. It's very difficult to deal with. But yeah, generally, my understanding is that you have to register for Medicare and start paying for it. Usually, what happens is when you register for Medicare, most people take Social Security already by the time they reach 65. The median age at which people take Social Security is 63, meaning half take it sooner and half take it after that. So a good portion of people who reach 65 and have Medicare eligibility already are taking Social Security, then they deduct the premium directly from the Social Security. You're delaying it, which can be a very wise idea if you live long enough, but then the Medicare department says, well, we still need your premium for it, and therefore there's kind of a penalty if you don't take Social Security unless you register properly. So just contact the Medicare office, explain your situation. You won't be the first person, Judy, to have this issue. They'll tell you how to handle it, make sure you keep your premiums as low as possible.
Judy, thanks so much for the question, for calling in. Let's move to Beta, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Beta.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
And my question is, I have two kids who are 7 and 3, and I would like to save some money for their schooling or for their future. So what's the best plan to save some money for their education or for their future?
Hi, Beta. Probably that EdVest College Savings Program is the best way, but one of the issues that many parents have is they're trying to take care of a lot of different financial goals at the same time. Pay the bills, maybe pay off debt, save for their own retirement, and then save for college. And if you're struggling with trying to decide where your next dollar should go, and saving for retirement is one of your goals, you may actually want to save money into a Roth IRA for yourself. And the reason being is that, you can borrow money to go to college, but you can't borrow money to retire. So you should prioritize that goal. It's kind of like when you fly in an airplane, the flight attendant gives you information on what to do in case of an emergency. And they always say, if you're traveling with a small child and the oxygen mask dropped down, put your mask on first, then put the mask on the small child. It's the same way of saving for retirement versus saving for college. You want to take care of that retirement goal first before saving for college. But by using a Roth IRA, you don't get any tax break on the contributions, but any tax earnings in the future won't be taxed at all if you pull them out, usually after 59 and a half. But you can use it as a college savings account, Beta, because you can pull the contributions to a Roth IRA back out at any time for any reason with no penalties or taxes whatsoever. So all the money you put into the Roth IRA, those contributions can be pulled back out to pay for college or pay for an emergency or whatever. It can kind of serve as a savings account. So I would first open a Roth IRA if you're eligible, if you're married, and you're eligible for a spousal contribution as well. You can put in up to $11,000 per year for two people, $5,500 apiece. And that's a lot of money towards reaching your goals.
Well, Beta, thanks so much for calling in and for the question. Are you sorting through a money situation that came up in your life during 2017? Kevin McKinley is here fielding questions of all sorts on this edition of On Your Money following such a wonderful reception on the year-end pledge drive. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Your money questions are front and center at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll return in just a moment. It's On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. You answered the challenge on this recent year-end pledge drive, and now it's your questions taking center stage this week. Go ahead and ask your pressing financial question at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is here. He's the go-to financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Let's go back to the phones with Cody joining us from Platteville. Hi, Cody.
Hi. I recently started going back to college, and I remain to have a $8,000 credit card balance. But the problem with going to college is I'm not working full-time anymore, and I can't catch up on my credit card because it's $160 a month interest. Now, I already did a balance transfer with 0% interest to another credit card for $3,000, so I'm actually down to $8,000. I was wondering if there's anything else I can do in order to either find a way to lower that interest rate or get it transferred to something else.
Yeah, sure, Cody. You must have like a bank account or a credit card or credit union account, right?
Yeah, I'm with a credit union.
Great. Have you contacted them to see what they could offer you?
Yeah, they said that with that limit and me no longer working full time,
right,
I am not eligible any longer for a loan of that size.
Okay. Yeah, that is an issue for it. And have you applied for financial aid as for part of your schooling?
Yes.
Okay. You know, this sounds crazy, and it's something that doesn't work for every person for, but one thing you might want to do is student loans generally have lower interest rates and longer repayment terms than credit card accounts do. And so you may want to borrow as much as you can for the for student loans, but then use some of the proceeds to hopefully pay off the credit card bill and then use the cash that was then going to the credit card bill to help pay for ongoing school expenses if you can make those numbers work. Now, one of the tricks of this, though, is you have to figure out how you got into this hole in the first place. And it's a very shallow hole, Cody. $8,000 on credit cards is way below the average amount that Americans have who do have credit card balances. That's actually closer to probably about $15,000 or $16,000. So you're still below it. And the fact that you're going back to school hopefully means that you'll get some kind of degree, a higher income, and be able to pay off all of your debts. So it's a really good idea to do what you're doing. But you just have to make sure to keep the game going by trying to stay current on everything. Because some things that you know, sometimes you can get the degree, and if you've run into financial trouble while you were earning the degree, sometimes, depending on the job and the employer, an adverse credit history can affect your employability. And so I really want to make sure you stay current on those as much as possible. You might want to contact the credit card company as well and see if there's a way that you can, you know, lower the interest rate on it, if there's a way that you can defer payments on it. But just don't worry about paying the bill off right now. Just make the interest payments. How much more schooling do you have, Cody, in terms of years?
I might end up going for my master's, but as of right now, it's only another year and a half.
Okay, that's pretty good, and that will go by hopefully very quickly, and then you'll be in the shape enough where you'll be able to earn the money to pay that off. But contact the credit card company, see what they can do, and then again, try to get some financial aid if you can. And are you obviously working, it sounds like, while you're going to school?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, it stinks. Something a lot of us went through. It's just part of the deal. You may even want to take fewer credits and actually so you can have more time to not only study but to work and then pay cash for your other expenses so you don't go further into debt.
Well, Cody, good luck. Thanks for the question. Along a similar vein, Andy from Madison emailed to ask, does paying off a number of low balances on your credit card increase your credit score more than paying off a low balance once a month? Also, do you have to let the balance roll over to the next month before you pay it off to let the credit companies recognize it?
It does take a while for that information to get in there, and it's an issue that people have when they're trying to pay the credit cards off, is trying to decide how quickly you go. Usually, it's kind of a horse apiece. You're splitting hairs by trying to save for it. So pay it off as quickly as you possibly can, but contact the credit card company to see when they first start billing on that balance, because usually there's kind of a grace period.
So Mary says, I turned 70 in November, Kevin. I know I have to take money out of my retirement fund soon. What date do I use to determine what amount to withdraw? And what is the advantage, disadvantage of waiting the allowed 6 months?
Well, let's start with the date. People who are over 70 and a half and have their own IRAs usually have to take a certain dollar amount by December 31st every single year. And it first happens starting the year when the IRA owner turns 70 and a half, not 70, 70 and a half. So if Mary turns 70 November, she doesn't turn 70 and a half until May of next year. So her actual first deadline is December 31st of 2018, a year from now. And she can even wait till the following April 1st for that first withdrawal to come out. So that's April 1st of 2019. But if she waits that long now, she'll still have to take a second one out later in 2019 and then one every year after that.
Any advantages to taking one each year versus two in 2019?
Yeah, usually there can be a tax savings because it might push her into a higher tax bracket if she takes two in one particular year, or there might be a change in her personal situation. She might have more income this year than she will next, or vice versa. Or there could very well be a change in the tax laws that would behoove her to wait to take them or accelerate them and take it sooner rather than later.
And how is the RMD calculated?
What you do is you add up all of your tax-deferred retirement accounts, your IRAs, your 401ks, your 403bs, and then you divide by an IRS divisor. And Schwab and Vanguard and Fidelity all have calculators you can use to figure out what your required minimum distribution amount may be. And the retirement account holder will also be able to do it for you as well. But it's your responsibility to figure out what you have to take out and when. And if you forget to take it out or you don't take out the proper amount, the IRS can impose a 50% excise tax on whatever you should have taken out but didn't. So if you were supposed to take $1,000 out and you didn't, they'll hit you with a $500 penalty, basically. Plus, you still have to take the $1,000 out and still pay taxes on it. So it's based on age and life expectancy, and you can take all of your IRA-required RMDs out of one IRA account, even if you have several different IRAs, but you can't commingle the 401k and 403b accounts as well. You have to take an RMD out of each like account.
Is there anything else listeners should know about IRA required minimum distributions?
Yes, the charitable deductions still exist. It can be very valuable for people in 2017. IRA owners who are over 70 and a half can donate some or all of their required minimum distribution tax-free to a qualified charitable organization. And it can be just about any 501c3, again, including Wisconsin Public Radio. And even if you don't itemize, the money still goes tax-free directly to the charity. And that can be very helpful because a lot of means testing in the way of benefits or taxation on Social Security or Medicare premiums, that can be affected by your income. But if you take your RMD and transfer some or all of it directly to the charity, it won't make those other income sources or components of means testing more likely to be taxable. So it can end up saving you quite a bit of money. But you can get that even if you don't itemize, but it must be done by the year end. So contact the charity right now, and they will be more than happy to help you make sure you get the RMD qualified distribution by December 31st.
And working through these questions, there was a question from Mike who wants information on year-end strategies to reduce taxes. Mike says, I inherited some property this year and sold it recently a bit unexpectedly. Mike was thinking of putting a large percentage of the funds into a college savings fund for his two teenage sons, but it looks like only $3,100 per fund can be utilized against my taxes.
Mike is correct, and we alluded to it earlier. EdVest is Wisconsin's 529 college savings account, but deposits to that account only reduce state income taxes and only about $3,100 per beneficiary per deposit per year. That's the maximum you can use. You can put in a bunch more than that, but only $3,100 will reduce your taxes. And again, you save about $100 to $150 in taxes for each contribution of that size that you make per beneficiary.
Any other suggestions for Mike?
Yeah. Yeah, if he and if he's married, the spouse is working, bump up any contributions to 401ks or 403bs before the end of the year. Or they also may be able to make tax-deductible IRA contributions by April 15th of next year. And don't forget, even if you're married and you're working or vice versa, you can open up a spousal IRA or Roth IRA as well. And the spousal IRA, at least, would give them a greater tax break on the deposit.
And so what if those moves aren't applicable in their situation?
They might want to think about giving some to charity. Many people believe it's better that to go directly to the charity rather than sending it to, you know, Madison or Washington, D.C., and hoping that that money gets back to causes that you're passionate about. So you give it to the charity. You can get a tax break on it as long as you itemize. Better yet, for people who have a kind of a windfall, they might want to look at a donor-advised fund. That's a kind of a mini foundation. You can put in as little as $5,000, but you can put in several million if you want. And it gives you a big tax break right now, but then the money can be invested for you, and you don't have to give it out in any specific year. You get the big tax break now, and then in the future, you can give out $100, $500, whatever, to a different charity every single year, or just choose not to give anything at all. You get the tax break now, and then no tax break in the future, but the tax break sounds like it'll be more valuable to Mike today than it would be in future years.
Let's squeeze in one more call here. Bill in Delavan. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. Are you there with us, Bill? Oh, Bill just dropped. If you have a question, call in 800-642-1234. You can also post your question on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Kevin, as we round out the year here, any final things that we can do as December comes to a close and we finish out 2017?
Yes, we can answer some more requests from listeners for their websites of the week. We had several people who emailed us in the past week or so saying, I'm really looking for information on how I can go about cutting the cable cord. And I know you discussed this in the previous weeks, but I can't remember the websites you mentioned how to do that. So we have three different websites you can use. Recode.net has a great guide of how to find the different channels out there and which streaming services offer each channel, whether it's HBO or Major League Baseball or ESPN or PBS. CanIStream.it tells you if it's possible to view a movie or a television show online and where it's broadcast. And then GroundedReason.com provides a ton of information on people who are interested in cutting the cord, hopefully saving some money, and getting the programming that they want. Again, Recode.net, CanIStream.it, and GroundedReason.com. And we'll put those websites at our website, OnYourMoney.com, again, later on today.
And there's a new website as well that you want to talk about.
That is correct. There's a wonderful website by the name of largeheartedboy.com. Largeheartedboy.com does a really cool thing every single year. And if you're looking for gifts for somebody or a gift for yourself, this is a great place to go, because what they've done is they have put together several dozen different best of book lists, and places that, you know, different publications, different websites have said best books for teenage girls or best sci-fi books of 2017 or whatever. And there's dozens you can go through. So if you're looking for a book idea for a specific subject or a specific person in an age or gender demographic, whatever, they have a ton of lists on there. It's largeheartedboy.com, and it's the online best of 75 different lists that you can choose from for different books. And again, we'll have that at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Chances are there's a personal finance list on there somewhere.
Yeah, if not, I'll add one.
Very good. Well, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8 and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This hour of the morning show was produced by Bill Martins and Amanda Magnus, with technical direction by executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.